From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Bert Kearns returns to the show this week. He's the author of Lawrence Tierney, Hollywood's real-life tough guy, and Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel, both excellent books. And his brand new book, also excellent, is Shemp, the biography of the Three Stooges, Shemp Howard, the face of film comedy. Bert Kearns, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, great to be back.
Shemp! I like the title.
It's not with an exclamation point.
It's not Shemp. Yeah, it's Shemp! You know, one of the things I love about your books is, I love them because they're well-written and interesting, but also because they send me back to my film library, watching films. I did that with Lawrence Tierney and with Brando, and now I'm doing it with Shemp, and I find all these wonderful Shemp performances. I was watching Buck Privates the other day. What a great movie. I've seen it, I'm sure, a million times, but I was like concentrating on it. And that sort of rap number that Luke Costello and Shemp do is...
that was it. I mean, that's where Shemp fit in his solo career, where he could pop into a film for one scene that just, you know, was a real crowd pleaser if he wasn't through the entire movie. But he wound up making five pictures with Abbott and Costello, and a couple of Abbott and Costello pictures that Abbott and Costello weren't in.
Right. That's right.
Buck Privates, you know, it was an enlistment comedy, 1942. It was the film that made Abbott and Costello superstars. And Universal couldn't get Abbott and Costello movies out fast enough, or couldn't make enough Abbott and Costello films. So they began to make Abbott and Costello comedies without Abbott and Costello. And there was a picture called San Antonio Rose, entertainers versus a group of mobsters trying to take over a roadhouse and turn it into a nightclub. And in this, they paired Shemp with Lon Chaney Jr. in the Abbott and Costello role. Now, which would have worked, except that Lon Chaney Jr., this is before he went on to do the Wolfman and horror films, was not funny whatsoever. And through this entire picture, he is just hitting and punching Shemp. And it's painful to watch. It really is painful to watch the abuse that Shemp takes in this picture.
You know, you just brought up a thing that when I was reading your book, I really was shocked to discover. I always assumed that they had some kind of trick way of hitting each other, and it was all sound effects added, and that didn't actually hurt each other. But you said in your book that they're constantly hurting each other.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. The Three Stooges started out with a pair of brothers. It was Shemp Horowitz, Samuel Horowitz, and who was born in 1895, and his brother Moses, who became known as Mo Howard. He was born 2 years later. 6 years after Mo came the baby of the family, Jerome, who was later known as Curly. So Shemp and Mo started out as teenagers in vaudeville. They started out doing a blackface act. You know, believe it or not, two, you know, white kids were ripping off two black performers. They took a group called Moss and Fry, two very popular African American act, and they just copied their act, did their jokes, went on the vaudeville circuit doing that. And then they hooked up with a friend of Moe's from childhood named Ted Healy. Healy was a Broadway and vaudeville song and dance man and singer, comedian. He had an act. He had a troupe. He had a troupe of dancers with him, and he had a troupe of sidemen that were his stooges, although they weren't called stooges at the time. There was a group of them. And what would happen was that Healy would be singing a song or doing a routine, and he'd be interrupted by someone from the audience or by a stagehand handing him a note. They do a bit of comedy, and the comedy would always end with Healy slapping the stooge in the face as hard as he could so that it was loud enough to be heard in the last row of the highest balcony. It was known as a roughhouse act, and that's how they got started. They got started as Ted Healy's stooges. They eventually left the act. They had picked up Larry Fine, and it was Mo, Shemp, and Larry Fine. They went out. Shemp quit the act, went solo, and the younger brother took over for him. Curly took over. And very significantly, Mo took over the Ted Healy role as the authoritarian, as the guy in charge. And he dealt out most of the slaps, the pokes, the kicks, whatever else they would give in this roughhouse, you know, slapstick violence that the Three Stooges really pioneered. They did this on film. They did it in movie shorts. When they did movie shorts from the 1930s through the 1960s even, they were able to use sound effects. The sound effects, if you watch a pie fight with the Three Stooges, it's violent. These pies are hitting people's faces like sledgehammers with these sound effects. But when they were on stage, and Mo made sure to keep them on stage in all of their off weeks from not filming their shorts, they were on stage doing this act for 20, 30 years getting hit. And there were not sound effects. They were getting hit for real. Larry Fine, who was the guy with the porcupine hair, as I said, had the whole left side of his face was calloused. Some people said it was because he played violin as a younger performer when he played violin all his life. But he said it's because all the slaps that he took.
Well, but what about when they poked each other in the eye or pulled their hair? There was a trick to that, right?
Well, there was ultimately a trick to that. Mo actually got the idea during a card game when they were sitting backstage playing cards, and Larry apparently was cheating, and Shemp got angry and poked him in the eyes. And Mo just thought that was hilarious and began poking him in the eyes. And then he kind of came up with the idea of hitting him a little bit higher in the head. A little clue to that is that, you know, both Larry, who died, I think he was in his 70s, but Curly, who died at 48, Shemp, who died at 60, all three of them died basically of cerebral hemorrhages. And when Curly was first brought into a hospital and diagnosed, he had a lot of hemorrhaging behind his eyes. And that could come from slaps in the head, that could come from, you know, getting hit like football players. It could also come from pokes as well, you'd think.
So
Mo was the only one who did not die of a cerebral hemorrhage. Mo was the one.
He was doing the hitting.
Yeah, he lived till 77, and he always said, he would say, I was the smart one. I took Ted Healy's place. I dished it out.
Well, I was sure that it was a trick, but now I know. It's terrible. What a horrible way to go. They
well, it's funny.
From being hit.
As I say, it's not really funny, but you know, the Three Stooges, when they were first popular, they were making film shorts, 15-minute comedies that would run in a theater. After the newsreel, they would play a comedy short, and then you would see the main feature, a Cagney film or a John Wayne picture. They got a second life in the 1960s when Screen Gems sold all the Three Stooges shorts to television to be syndicated. And at that point, their audience changed from moviegoers and adults to kids like me. I'd get home from school, I'd watch Officer Joe Bolton on WPIX in New York, mm-hmm. and watch the Three Stooges, then hit my brother on the head with a hammer, and then get yelled at by my mother for being violent.
Rake a saw over his head.
But there's an interview out there, you can see it on YouTube, of Mo with Larry, and I think at the time it was Curly Joe DeRita, the final stooge who took over, explaining to a reporter that, look, kids, we have kids watching us now, so you have to know, we don't really hurt each other. When we do that eye poke, I'm actually, you know, and he was demonstrating how he fakes everything, which he did fake to a degree on camera, but never when they were live.
Yeah, wow. It's crazy, isn't it? What a way to make a living. You know, it's interesting now too, because I think during their heyday and all the way up until recently, the Marx Brothers were thought of as, you know, real comedy, a class act, higher level of artistry, and they made a lot more money than the Three Stooges did. But I mean, today I think the Three Stooges are far more in vogue than the Marx Brothers. A lot of the reason I think is that the Marx Brothers, you have to know a lot to get the references in the Marx Brothers. Things that, I mean, when Groucho says there's nothing like liberty except Collier's in the Saturday Evening Post, who has any idea what he's talking about? Whereas when somebody pokes somebody in the eye, you don't need any background information. It's just funny.
Right. I mean, you know, the Marx Brothers had great writers like, you know, George S. Kaufman and, you know, Broadway writers, and they were a bit more intellectual than the Stooges. They were truly anarchic in their comedy. The Three Stooges, you know, wreaked havoc, but they're much more of a primal slapstick. I mean, the thing about them was their choreography and, you know, their timing was perfect. the Three Stooges were just as accomplished as the Marx Brothers, but came from a whole different place. You know, they came from that roughhouse vaudeville act, which played to the common people, which played to the masses. And they did that, you know, from the time they were in vaudeville through the time they were on television. They had that very basic, you know, appeal. And that's why you look at, you know, who are the successors to the Three Stooges? You know, I'm always asked that question. You have to figure, is it America's Funniest Home Video? And, you know,
yeah,
dad steps on a rake and gets hit in the head.
Yeah.
People are getting hit with the baseball between the legs. Or yeah. Or is it, you know, World Wrestling, you know, WWE, when they mix that comedy and violence? But you see it in comedies all the time. Somebody showed me recently the movie The Hangover, where, you know, Bradley Cooper gets tased by Rob Riggle. He's playing a cop demonstrating tasering to a bunch of kids. And just, you know, he tases Bradley Cooper, and then he feels the pain, and it's hilarious to watch.
Yeah, I really think the real successors to the Three Stooges are the Three Stooges, since you can still get every single one of their shorts. There's a Blu-ray box set that just came out, and has all kinds of not just their shorts, but even Shemp Howard's shorts. I mean, they're still alive and well in the world of video.
Yes, there's a real Three Stooges fan community out there still. That's just, you know, nice and strong.
Which is great. You know, yeah. I saw a film not too long ago called The Fighting Kentuckian. It's a John Wayne film, and Oliver Hardy plays a role in it. And he plays a wonderful role, which is nothing like the character of Ollie that he played in all the Laurel and Hardy comedies from 1927 on. And there's another film, too, called Zenobia that Oliver Hardy is in without Stan Laurel. And it gives you the idea that in some alternate universe, Oliver Hardy could have been a great character actor playing a wide variety of roles, which is kind of what happened with Shemp Howard. So he's a Three Stooge, then he's not a Three Stooge. He does all these amazing parts. And then he's a stooge again.
That's the thing with Shemp, and that was one of the things I came across when I was writing this. You know, this started as a biography project. You approach it the same way, but as I got into it, I kept finding things that didn't add up. Looking through the, you know, there had never been, when we started this, there had never been a book about Shemp Howard. There had been books about Mo, Larry, Curly. There've been books about Joe Derita, even, you know, and Joe Besser. They all had books. There'd been nothing written about Shemp. And when I started digging into it, I was finding that dates didn't match up. Things that had been written were wrong. And I kind of found that the reason is that I'm not from the Three Stooges fan community. I liked the Stooges as a kid. I'm not trying to insult anyone to say I grew out of them, you know, moved on in the 1960s. To, you know, Monty Python and Cheech and Chong and George Carlin. But most of the people who have written books about the Three Stooges are parts of that fan community. And all of them go back to what I call the Bible, which is the autobiography that Mo Howard wrote at the end of his life in the 1970s. He died before he completed it. His daughter finished it for him. And it's his story of the Three Stooges' history. And as I found out, it's very self-aggrandizing. A lot of it is fictional, and much of it is at the expense of his brother, Shemp, who is painted as a neurotic, phobic crybaby, scared of his own shadow, very much like the character he portrayed in The Three Stooges. But when you look at Shemp's solo career, the 14 years that he spent as a solo artist, he never played that character. No, he played gangsters. He played braggarts. He played loudmouths. He played the henpecked husband. You know, in one movie, he played in a drama called Convention Girl, in which he played a Joe Pesci-like character who he's sort of funny until he shoots his partner, you know, who demands man some money. He was much more of a well-rounded and versatile actor than the other Stooges were, who really were just caricatures. You know, they were cartoon characters, and Shemp wasn't.
Well, maybe if they had the opportunity to act in films in which they were not playing the roles of Larry Moe and Curly, they might have shown more talent as an actor.
Yeah, well, I mean, Moe, later in his life, Moe appeared in a couple of films, but he still played Moe.
Yeah.
But that was also Moe's dream. I mean, when you read Moe's book, from the time he was 11, he wanted to be a thespian. He wanted to be an actor. He wanted to be in the great plays. And he really never got that chance. And I think there was some jealousy involved in the fact that Shemp did. Shemp did have that chance. And, you know, Shemp gave up that freedom. He gave up that a very successful role as a character actor and as a solo artist in his own shorts at the time. He gave that up to help his brother Mo when his younger brother Curly in 1945 became incapacitated by a stroke and couldn't go on any longer. And he took over, you know, Curly's role, which was a very thankless job. I mean, how do you take over for Curly? I mean, Curly was, you know, otherworldly. He was, you know, he was beyond Belushi or Chris Farley. He was just, you know, he was a big, you know, kid who barked like a dog and spun around on the floor. And while Shemp was a man, Shemp was, you know, looked like a man. Every mile of vaudeville that he traveled was on that face of his.
I was in 1974, I was in the Shermart Market on Santa Monica and Robertson with my girlfriend, and I saw this little man, old man with gray hair, standing in line waiting to buy a grapefruit. And I said, "Oh, that's Mo Howard." And she goes, "Who's Mo Howard?" And I went up to him and I said, "Aren't you Mo Howard?" He goes, "Yeah, you want my autograph?" And he had a huge stack of Three Stooges pictures in his vest pocket that he pulled out. He autographed it for me, and then everybody saw it, and then they all kind of gathered around for 10 minutes while he signed autographs.
That's terrific. And that, you know, that was Mo. Mo had, you know, Shemp died in 1955, and Mo survived him by, you know, by 20 years. And in those 20 years, the Three Stooges had their revival. They had that new audience of kids. And Mo would, you know, Mo would appear on television. He would appear on radio, and he would tell his version of the Stooges' history. And that, you know, history is written by the survivors. History is written by the victors, and he was the victor. He, you know, he outlived them all.
Well, we're talking with Bert Kearns, and he's the author of a wonderful new book called Shemp, the biography of the Three Stooges. Shemp Howard, the face of film comedy. Let's talk a little bit more about Ted Healy. So, I had always heard that Ted Healy had been murdered by Wallace Beery in a bar, but you don't think that's actually true.
I spoke with Bill Cassera. He's an author, a former police investigator who is Ted Healy's biographer. And yes, you know, Ted Healy was an alcoholic, a heavy drinker and a womanizer. And there was a story that, I guess what happened with him was that his first son was born and he went on a bit of a bender after the birth of his son. Was on Sunset Boulevard at a club called the Tropicana, made a little bit too much of a ruckus. And according to the story, he was either taken out into the parking lot or at the bar, got into a fight with Cubby Broccoli, a young man who later grew up to become the producer of the James Bond pictures.
Yeah.
he went home and he was very ill. He was very sick, I guess, from, you know, from his drinking. And he died a couple of days later at home. According to Cassera, who I guess saw the autopsy results, the beating had nothing to do with it. It all had to do with his internal, you know, issues because of all the drinking that he did.
So Wallace Beery wasn't involved at all.
He may have been in the bar. He may have given a punch or two. I'm not really sure. But apparently he didn't murder him.
No. But Ted Healy was not a well-liked personality in Hollywood.
No. And he's, you know, he's sort of a forgotten character now. But he was very talented. I mean, he was a guy who, if you look at the reviews of all the vaudeville shows they would do, and even on Broadway, the reviews for Ted Healy were always great. He could always get a laugh. He could always get a song across. And he was often the high point of any of the shows he was in. But he was a tough boss, and he was cheap. And he battered these guys around on stage. That was another thing. I mean, according to Mo, Shemp had left the act in 1931 because he was afraid of Ted Healy. He was afraid because Ted Healy, again, he was tired of getting beaten up by Ted Healy all the time. Healy was abusive off stage, off camera. And that has become part of the Three Stooges history. Again, when I started looking into it and finding, you know, the records and the finding, you know, from newspaper and trade magazine articles, you find out that, you know, it was in print. Shemp left the act because he actually was the star of the act alongside Ted Healy. You know, they weren't called the Three Stooges at the time. There were maybe four or five Stooges, or maybe there might have been six working with Healy, but Shemp was the main Stooge. He had his name in lights, just in the same type size as Ted Healy's. And he said to Healy, "I want more money. I deserve more money." And Healy said, "Well, you know what? At this point, I'm paying the three of you a certain amount, change the split with them." And when they refused to change the split, Shemp walked and walked into the great unknown and began a solo career in his own comedy shorts right around the same time the Three Stooges did.
Were you able in your research, Burt Kearns, to determine how much money they all made? And
at the time, they were splitting $450 a week. So I don't know what that adds up to in today's money.
Yeah.
And they weren't, by the end, they weren't doing bad. They were making in the equivalent of about $225,000 a year from their film work. You know, they all lived very comfortably. These guys weren't living in, you know, one bedroom apartments with hot plates. They had nice houses in the Toluca Lake neighborhood, which is on the edge of the San Fernando Valley, where Bob Hope and Bing Crosby also lived in that neighborhood. They weren't doing poorly at all, but Mo was always trying to get. I guess it was that old, you know, work ethic from the vaudeville days of always keeping them working. So they weren't working all year on these shorts. By the time Shemp was there, they were maybe working, you know, maybe 7 weeks, 8 weeks a year, because they'd cut the budgets back on the shorts. They maybe would be shooting a few scenes that they would intercut with old shorts and turn them into new ones. It was all sort of, you know, hit and miss with what they were doing. But Mo kept them on the road all the time when they weren't working at the studio.
Well, there's a couple of things in your book, Shemp, to say it with an exclamation point. After Jerry or Curly had his stroke on the set, they were very concerned, but nevertheless went right back to work after they took Curly to the hospital and went right back to work. And when Shemp died, they went right back to work on shorts that Shemp was in, but he wasn't actually in them.
That's the best. That was even mentioned like in Shemp's obits at the time, his obituaries, which was, you know, Shemp Howard had died. The Three Stooges still owe four more shorts to Harry Cohn at Columbia Pictures. And Cohn demanded that they make those shorts. So again, what they did was they took some older material they did, which had Shemp in it, and they took one of the characters, Joe Palma, who was one of the supporting characters, and put him into scenes. You'd see him, he wore sort of a wig and you saw him from behind. And they either added Shemp's voice from the old film, one of the old films, or they had him do a bit of grunting. And they made four pictures with starring Shemp after Shemp's death.
Well, that's
Palma
weird.
Became known as the fake Shemp, which is now a term used in Hollywood whenever another actor fills in for a lead actor who either has, you know, died before the production is over or can't be there for the shoot.
Fake Shemp. Was there a lack of sentiment? You know, I mean, didn't they feel anything when their brother died?
Well, they did. You know, they were close. As much as you hear about, you know, about Moe's ways when it came to money and work, et cetera, they were still a very close family. Shemp was the real mensch. I mean, that's why he rejoined the Stooges, you know, to help his brother Mo. They stayed close, you know, although they had competing careers at the time, the family did stay close. And there was sentiment, but then again, the Three Stooges, by the time Shemp died, were not the hottest ticket on the Columbia lot. And that was their ticket, you know, for food. That was their work. So, yeah, they mourned Shemp, but got right back to work. Same as with Curly.
There was a certain lack of job security. That is, every single year they had to be renewed like they would on a TV series now. I mean, they ended up doing the shorts, as you mentioned, from the 30s to the 60s, but every year it was a question whether they would continue.
Yeah, and they weren't getting, you know, big raises throughout that time period either. You know, Mo had taken over, you know, contractually with the others. He took over as the person who negotiated their salaries. And they say that he never asked for a raise ever. He was always in a position where he just felt lucky to be working. And the fact that they were stuck doing these shorts, which were losing popularity by the beginning of the 50s, you know, they were showing double features in pictures, and the shorts weren't, you know, really a moneymaker for them. That's why the budgets on the shorts never got any bigger with, you know, they never increased with inflation or whatever. So yeah, they always felt lucky to be working.
Well, you know, the Marx Brothers never made shorts. They only made features. And Laurel and Hardy started in shorts, but then when they moved to features, you know, in the 30s, they never looked back. They made mostly only features. They did a three-reeler in 32, but most of them were features. Why didn't the Stooges just suddenly make features? Why did they continue to make shorts, even after the shorts were... I mean, most studios abandoned shorts in 1948 or so.
Yeah, I think they made one feature with Shemp. They may have made one with Curly early on. But Moe would say, well, no, you know, then we would use up all of our... And that's actually what Harry Cohn and Jules White, who ran the shorts division of Columbia, would say. Well, we'd be using up too many of the routines that we would need for the shorts, because they had a pretty successful short subject division at Columbia, not just with the Stooges, but with people like Leon Errol and for a long time, Shemp Howard. Shemp had his own shorts going for about 5 years at Columbia, which, again, were very funny. But at the same time, they were using the same directors and a lot of the same supporting cast as the Three Stooges. Sometimes some reheated scripts from the Three Stooges, which was the way they worked.
So, and a couple with Fatty Arbuckle. A couple with Fatty Arbuckle, too, with Shemp and Fatty Arbuckle.
Yes, as a matter of fact, that was early on. Fatty Arbuckle, who had his career had been ended with a rape and manslaughter trial, although he was acquitted, he kind of was drummed out of the business. Warner Brothers gave him a deal to star in a bunch of, I think, four film shorts in the early 1930s. It was the first time you ever got to hear Fatty Arbuckle's voice, because these weren't silent pictures. And Shemp co-starred in two of them. And one of them, they finished work for the day. Fatty Arbuckle went back to his hotel room in Manhattan and died. It was Fatty Arbuckle's very last film appearance.
It was with Shemp.
Yeah.
Did I come in here last night and did I spend a $20 bill? Asks W.C. Fields in The Bank Dick. And Shemp says, yeah. Oh, what a relief. I thought I lost it.
Yeah. See, that's, again, that's an example, you know, of Shemp's versatility. I think in The Bank Dick, which is one of, you know, Fields' classics, Shemp's sort of the straight man. And he's the one, like, human character in this crazy picture. And he was very diverse in his roles. He appeared in a picture with Marlena Dietrich, John Wayne, and Randolph Scott. Again, he was in five Abbott Costello pictures. He appeared in several films with the Dead End Kids. He was in one of the Thin Man pictures with William Powell and Myrna Loy.
Yeah. He turns up anywhere. You never know where Shemp will turn up.
He was in Arabian Nights as Sinbad in the Ali Baba movie with Sabu. You know, of course, he played Sinbad with a Brooklyn accent. It was a comic relief role. But he was one of those actors that could be just fit into any picture. And, you know, he had this whole bag of tricks that he would use. You know, and one of them was the blind man. He'd put on these Coke bottle glasses and walk around like he couldn't see. He was in several movies like that. In two pictures, he was mute. He played a mute because he was very good at physical comedy. He was just as balletic and just as good as Curly was, but he's also great at ad-libs. He was also known for that. He'd go in there and he would just ad-lib parts of his role and be really funny.
You know, there's a chapter in your book where you mention that he's the ugliest man in Hollywood. And I thought, well, he's not that ugly. But then I looked at the beautiful color photograph of him on the cover of your book, Bert Kearns, Shemp. And it's a beautiful ugliness. But yeah, no, his skin alone was like a pockmarked. He's incredibly ugly. Yeah.
Well, you know, Drew Friedman, the artist who wrote the foreword for the book.
Yeah.
Shemp, it was his muse. You know, Drew usually likes to do pictures of, he started by drawing famous monsters, you know, from,
right.
He loved Frankenstein and et cetera, and the Wolfman. But when he saw Shemp, that was the face he always wanted to draw. And, you know, during that, the filming of the movie Butch Minds the Baby is a Damon Runyon picture where Shemp played a gangster. It was a comic gangster, Damon Runyon gangster, like Guys and Dolls. And they had a scene where they had a lot of mugs, some of the, you know, retired boxers, all those great faces you used to see in Hollywood were gathered in this one scene. And a press agent came up with the idea of saying, wait a minute, let's say there was a contest for the ugliest man in Hollywood and that the actresses, you know, did the voting. And they mentioned Shemp as the ugliest man in Hollywood. And he loved the fact that he had the role. He said, yeah, I sure am. Yes. I'm a groundhog. Every day I look in the mirror and I know I'm the ugliest. He was very proud of that.
Well, what kind of a person was Shemp Howard off screen? What was he like off screen? Did you find out?
I mean, off screen, he was a real family man. He was married, to one woman from the time he was young. He had a son named Morton, and he was a family man. He also loved the sport of boxing. He for someone who was known to be, such a timid scaredy cat, he was sort of, you hear about Jack Nicholson or Spike Lee at basketball games. He was the Jack Nicholson of boxing at the local arena on Hollywood Boulevard. He would sit ringside, and when the boxers were going at it, he would sort of be going at it while he was watching them. And the whole crowd would be watching the ring and also watching Shemp in the first row doing his boxing. And then later the cornerman would come and towel off Shemp between rounds and get a big laugh. But one of the things I found was his daughter-in-law said she went to the fights with him. And when they all sat down, he handed everyone newspapers, this little group. And they're like, well, what's this for? He goes, well, that's to cover yourself with, because when the blood starts flying, we always get it in the first row.
Oh my God.
It was sort of like being at a Gallagher show wanting to dodge the water, flying watermelons. But this time it was actually blood. So he wasn't afraid of that. And it was and the boxing match was actually the last bit of entertainment he saw, because he died on the way home from a boxing match.
Only 60 years old. Seems very young now. Although he looked old, but I mean, he probably looked old when he was 20.
Yeah. He didn't look that bad when he was 20. That was the thing. When he was younger, Shemp was a sexy guy. He was taller than the other Stooges. He was about 5'6". The others are about 5'3". And he was a good looking guy. He had long hair at the time. But then he, got older. Then I guess all the beatings.
The ugliness set in. Well, when you see the Stooges with Ted Healy, they seem very small, and Ted Healy seems enormous. I mean, I don't know if Ted Healy was enormous, but he sure looks enormous when he's standing next to the Stooges.
Well, that was the thing. Mo says that Ted Healy, towered them at over 6 feet tall. I believe he was 5'9½" or 5'10". but
they were small.
Actually, yeah, truly, and he was just they were just little guys.
Yeah. Oh, great. People were shorter then. I think in general. Don't you think people are taller now? Young people seem to be much taller than
young. They're taller than I am. That's for sure.
So how did he meet his wife? What was her name?
His wife was also his wife was known as Babe, which was actually the nickname of Curly when he was growing up. So Curly changed his name to Curly from Babe. He met her. She was a neighborhood, a girl in the neighborhood in Bensonhurst when he was growing up. And they were together till his death. Yeah.
She was not in show business or in the act or anything.
She wasn't. Shemp has a daughter-in-law who is still alive. She's in her 90s now, and he's got two granddaughters. One of whom was a baby when he was still alive. The other one was born shortly after his death, and they have a Facebook page called the Shemp Howard Goyles Group. Where they talk about Papa Shemp and what they remember of Papa Shemp and the stories they've heard about Papa Shemp. And Geraldine, who is the daughter-in-law, has a lot of first-person stories about them. And they say that Mama, I guess they call her Mama Shemp, that's what they called his wife. She started out in show business early on. She was part of a dance troupe. But she never wanted to talk about exactly what went on. I didn't find any records of her work. But I think perhaps just briefly, she was in show business.
Talk a little bit more about Drew Friedman, who wrote the foreword to your book. I've always admired his work, and he has this wonderful detail in his drawings. I don't know if my listeners are familiar with his work, but it's always been great, a favorite of mine. He could draw Ernest Borgnine or somebody like that and really bring out it's photorealistic on the one level, but it's also grotesquely hilarious.
Yeah, Drew started out really sort of as a cartoonist, doing sort of underground cartooning with something called stippling, which is like a lot of dots and a lot of very pointillist thing where he would really like to draw. I think his brother would write the comics and then he would illustrate them. And there were crazy comics about Joe Franklin, historian who had his own local television show in New York. Again, Ernest Borgnine, Tor Johnson from the Ed Wood movies. He loves ugliness. He finds beauty in ugliness. And he's done a couple of books about old Jewish comics. And they've got the age spots and they've got the warts and everything. He loves that beauty. And he was one of the real popularizers of Shemp as a pop culture figure. Because again, when we were kids watching the Three Stooges after school, you know, for the first few years, Screen Gems put out dozens, because the Stooges made hundreds of shorts. They put out all the Mo, Larry, and Curly shorts, and all the kids identified with Curly. We loved Curly.
Yeah.
And then maybe like 2 years in, they started sprinkling in some Shemp shorts. And I was like, who is this? Who's this guy? Where's Curly? We want Curly. Who's this man? He's scary. And we couldn't appreciate Shemp. But then, okay, that was the 60s. Then came the 1970s. And then came, you know, Watergate and Vietnam and disco and punk. And around the time the punk era came around in the mid-70s, well, Shemp sort of became like, yeah, Shemp is punk. You know, Shemp is cool. We can identify with Shemp. He's cool. And around this time, you know, then Drew Friedman started drawing Shemp into the 80s and into the 90s. And you started seeing this image of this face. I think one of Drew's books, there's one of his portraits of Shemp on the cover of that. He even did a picture of Shemp for the cover of Screw magazine for some reason early on. And so, you know, Shemp's face just became this symbol, I think, of, you know, rebellion, and people started to, you know, appreciate Shemp.
Well, in addition to movies like Private Buckaroo and what was the other one you mentioned, San Antonio Rose, what are your favorite Shemp performances, including some Three Stooges shorts that people could easily find? Where should we look for the best of Shemp?
Well, first of all, you can go onto YouTube and all the Three Stooges stuff is out there. I think, you know, a lot of the streaming sites now have, you know, Three Stooges channels on them. There's some great Stooges shorts. If you look at the first three that he did in 1947, the first is called Fright Night, where he plays a boxer. And this was his first thing that he did when he rejoined the Stooges, and it's sort of a solo showcase for him. His first couple are solo showcases. There's another one called Brideless Groom, where Shemp finds out he's going to get an inheritance if he can get married, you know, within 24 hours. And it's just great comedy, great physical comedy. As for his movies, there's just the one to watch. You know, we're talking about the Abbott and Costello pictures without Abbott and Costello. The one to watch is, rather than Buck Privates, it's called Private Buckaroo. And it's got the Andrews sisters in it, just as most of the Abbott and Costello pictures did. And Shemp had it's another enlistment picture from 1942. It's musical comedy, and it's about, you know, Harry James plays himself being drafted into the army, and Shemp is a sergeant. Shemp had a secondary role originally, but the suits at Universal were watching it and saying Shemp is hilarious, and they cut out a lot of other scenes and other players, and concentrated on Shemp in this. And it's the closest thing you can find to a Shemp starring vehicle, and he pulls out all the stops. He's really funny in it. He does, you know, he dances and he does, you know, all of his slapstick stuff. Very well worth seeing. Another one worth
before you go finding. On, let's talk about that one for just a minute, because also Mary Wicks. The two of them are so great together. They could have had a whole series of pictures with Mary Wicks and Shemp Howard. They would have been a team.
Yeah, Mary Wicks as his girlfriend is terrific in it. Yeah,
she's twice his size.
A long career. Yeah.
But yeah, another one.
Another one that was worth finding is called Hollywood Roundup from 1937. This was part of a trilogy of films about behind the scenes of Hollywood Westerns. They're comedies. And in this one, Shemp plays the assistant director. They're trying to make a Western. And the star of the Western, of course, is this great cowboy, but behind the scenes, he's this spoiled, you know, actor, while the stuntman is gets a lot of bull from the star because he's jealous of him. Shemp plays this assistant director. It's, you know, in a film that it's up there with like the stuntman or Hail Caesar as a Hollywood parody. It's really funny. And Shemp is the center of this film, where he's got the megaphone, he's got the whistle, and he's always calling people back to the set and doing a lot of yelling. And if there's a tracking shot underneath a truck, Shemp is under the truck, you know, holding the megaphone. It's really worth finding that picture, Hollywood Roundup.
I have to find that. I don't know where it is. Is it on DVD? Probably not.
I saw it online, and I can't find it now. Oh. But it's out there.
Somebody, right, I'm gonna look for
somebody
it.
Will send it to you. It's out there.
Well, Bert Kearns, you wrote this great book about Lawrence Tierney a couple of years ago, kind of rediscovering this marvelous film noir actor whose career lasted from the vintage days of film noir up until Tarantino. Then you wrote this strange and wonderful biography of Marlon Brando, where you looked at him in a way that no one had ever looked at him before. And now you've written this book about Shemp. What's the connection? How do you move from Lawrence Tierney to Marlon Brando to Shemp? What goes on in the mind of Bert Kearns?
I never like to say this, but after Lawrence Tierney, my agent, Lee Sobel, who's more than an agent, he's a coach, and he collaborates on coming up with ideas, said, Bert, you've got to write a book about somebody that people have heard of. So, all right, you know, how about Marlon Brando? And, you know, the fact that Marlon Brando's centennial was coming up, that fit in right away. And then after that, you know, I'm always drawn to these people who make a real impression on me, but other people, again, might not have heard of. Again, I've done documentaries on Chris Montez, and did a documentary on Neil Innes, who was one of the collaborators with Monty Python. I would love to, you know, I've been trying to get a book together for a while on Louis Prima from Las Vegas in the 1950s. And I keep saying that I want to do a project on Richard Deacon.
Oh, yeah, sure. From
Mel Cooley from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
He also played
has a tremendous story.
Clarence's father on Leave It to Beaver, among other things.
Right. Yeah, he was Lumpy's father. Mm-hmm. And he appeared in that Napoleon movie with Marlon Brando.
Oh, uh-huh.
The name just escaped me right now.
Desiree.
Sorry, yeah. He was in Desiree. He appeared in that. But that's really what connects it. I mean, I find, you know, what interests me with Brando, again, that was a challenge, because what could be written about Marlon Brando that hasn't been written already? There have been so many books about Brando, you know, even Brando's own book, and sort of finding a different way in on that. And with Shemp, it was great because, first of all, again, it seemed to be virgin territory as far as finding the, you know, Shemp's path. And then once I got into it, finding out that everything I've heard is wrong. And I
yes. wanted sort of like, you know, did some rewriting
history work. Without not even realizing it.
Well, so what are you going to write next, Bert?
Don't know. Right now, I'm actually working on a documentary project. I'm producing and helping write and edit Legs McNeil's new documentary on Frank Lucas. It's called Pusher Man. Frank Lucas is the notorious Harlem drug dealer from the 1970s who Denzel Washington played in the film American Gangster.
Wow.
And it's the true story of, you know, Superfly in that era. And that should be coming out the beginning of 2025. We're kind of wrapping that up now.
Oh, that sounds interesting, too.
Yeah, there's always something.
Well, the something that we've been talking about is called Shemp, the biography of the Three Stooges, Shemp Howard, the face of film comedy, and the author, my guest, the brilliant Bert Kearns. Bert Kearns, thanks so much for being with us again and talking about Shemp, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Gary.
I recently read a biography of Zeppo Marx by Robert Bader, and although I knew a lot about Zeppo before I read the book because I'm a Marx Brothers aficionado myself, but one of the things I learned from that excellent book was that Zeppo Marx had adopted two sons, and one of these sons, Tim Marx, joins me right now. Tim Marx, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Great.
So were you a baby when you were adopted?
I think maybe 2 weeks old, somewhere in there, maybe three.
So you don't remember?
No, little tough to remember. What there used to be was adoption parties on the West Coast where people, and I can't think of the woman's name, would come and tell people, you know, they had children available. This is how Harpo and Susan got Alex, Jimmy, and Minnie.
Yes, Bill Marks has been a guest on this show before.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful guy. So it was kind of a thing that was happening. Hollywood people were adopting children.
Correct.
And well, in general, do you have pleasant or unpleasant memories of your childhood?
Well, I don't know that you could call it a childhood after age maybe 9 or 10. But early on, I thought it was fun. It was a normal sort of childhood, if you will. There were, you know, bicycles, there were Christmases, there were things that everybody else, other kids in the neighborhood did. And we all played together and had a good time.
And was the neighborhood in a neighborhood like Beverly Hills of movie
It
star?
Was absolutely Beverly Hills, yeah.
And of course, if Zeppo Marx was your father, then Groucho, Harpo, and Chico were your uncles. And
Exactly.
Gummo.
There you go.
And so,
Gummo lived almost catty-corner to where we wound up on Beverly Drive. Harpo lived around the corner, and that was the house to go to. That was a great place to be. Never went much to Groucho's house. Went maybe once or twice to Chico's apartment. But yeah, I mean, normal stuff.
Yeah, and do you have fond memories of your uncles?
I do. Harpo especially, who was a terrific guy. His son Bill and I are good friends. But that was the place where you could go and have fun. And you know, Susan was the one who encouraged Marion to adopt two children.
Your
And
mother.
Marion and Susan were best friends.
And your mother, she'd been a Ziegfeld Follies girl.
Not so much Ziegfeld Follies. She was an actress, did a lot of stage stuff, was good at what she did or at her craft, and that's how ultimately she wound up meeting Zeppa.
So tell us a little bit about your father. What are your memories?
A nice guy, very charming, funny, could be, but the next second he could be having a temper flare over something menial that either my brother or I would do, like break a window, let the dog out of the yard. I can remember an instance at one Christmas where he bought us some bikes, and we were living on Rexford Drive in a beautiful house. And Tom had got a red Schwinn bike, I got a green one, and my mother and I, she said, "Well, Tim, ride down the hill, and I can do that with some skill." Tom rode into Zeppo's shin and bloodied him pretty quickly. And it wasn't a fun breakfast after that.
He didn't just say, "Oh, boys will be boys."
No, he fumed. And boy, it didn't do anything to the cut, although my mother said, "Listen, you know, Zeppo, you really should get a band-aid or do something like that." No, he sat at the table in a white terry cloth bathrobe, bleeding from his shin, eating breakfast and fumed. Christmas morning, welcome.
You know. On Christmas, what a sad memory that would be. Awful. And you were, when your parents divorced, you were just maybe 10 years old?
Well, they started to have some difficulties younger than that. I think, you know, probably, well, they always fought. And much, much more so pronounced when we moved from Rexford, because Zeppo got tired of that house, and as he did with many things, time to move on to a new adventure, and he was going to build a house on Beverly Drive, which was a fantastic house. But we spent some time in a rented house on Rodeo Drive, and they argued quite a bit. And when we got to the Beverly Drive home, that arguing became more pronounced. And it was always, you know, Zeppo going to Las Vegas, and my mom not liking that a whole lot. And he was a sort of an absentee parent. But we lived among a lot of people who were, you know, in that business. We traveled quite a bit. But as I say, it was sort of a normal child.
How did your childhood change when your parents divorced?
Well, my brother and I were sent to military school, and I think that as you read the book, I think that was precipitated by the Singer episode with The Rock, where I happened to hit Denise Singer in the eye with a rock, and it was not a laughing matter at that point. But Zeppo fumed, and their problems deepened. And the answer was, wait a minute, we're getting a divorce. What are we going to do with these two guys? And so military school was the answer. I would refer to it as my beginning of my incarceration.
Wow. So you were just basically they no longer interested in having two sons, and they put you somewhere. Is that what you're saying?
Basically, they weren't interested in having us around while they settled their differences. I'm not sure that Zeppo, quite honestly, wanted us around, period.
Was your mother more sympathetic, or was she the same?
Oh, no. She was very sympathetic, and I think wanted the children, and took good care of us. I mean, she later on, after we moved to New York, she was, you know, the go-to person, provided for us and did a lot of things. Early on, I know that she resented Zeppo being the strict disciplinarian that he was.
Was there corporal punishment involved?
Yeah, there was. I mean, I would do things, and at Rexford Drive, I had the bed nearest the door on the second floor. And when things would happen, Zepp would run into his bathroom, grab the hairbrush, and I was the nearest choice. So he would yell, you know, drop your pants. And he'd give me a couple of whacks, and that would be it. And my brother would be across the room cringing.
Wow.
And, you know, that wasn't fun.
No, that doesn't sound like fun. do you have a good relationship with your brother now?
We have a distant relationship. We speak more now than we ever did before. It was a period of maybe, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years where we were estranged. He had moved to Boston to start a musical career, went to Berklee Musical School before he dropped out there. But he was having some issues, and we just didn't talk a whole lot.
Yeah. But now you are close.
Well, now we're not close, but we're a heck of a lot closer than we used to be.
Yeah.
I used to call him, and he would hang up on me or say, well, you know, if it wasn't for you, this wouldn't have happened. And okay, then we finally jumped that hurdle, and I would call him at Christmas and his birthday, and now I call him 5 or 6 times a year, and it's much better.
That's good to know. So at what point, how old were you when your mother moved to New York?
I think, well, it was military school halfway through the fourth grade. So call that 9. New York was halfway through the sixth grade. Call that 11, 12, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. So you left military school and lived the rest of your childhood in New York.
Yes, we got an early release, if you will.
When you were in New York, did you still have a relationship with your father and your uncles?
No, not the uncles. But Zeppo, on and off. I didn't really want to go to New York, but you know, I didn't have much of a choice in it. But Dad was not a guy who would communicate with you that much. He would communicate through Mom, but not directly with us. There was a period when we did go out there to see him, but that was, I think, a forced visit.
You'd go to Palm Springs?
Yeah, we did. Mm-hmm. We didn't get to go. Stayed in New York, loved New York, and Mom did a great job with the apartment, sending us to school and doing all that stuff. And Dad said, well, you know, when are they going to come out and visit? And we finally went and stayed out there for a week. I went out to visit Zeppo one summer when I was about 21. And there's a photo in the book that Barbara took, who was then Zeppo's wife, later Barbara Sinatra.
That's right,
and spent a weekend with him, and it was great. He staked me to the movies with a young woman he knew, and I came back the next day and left the change on the table. And he said to me, "What's that for?" I said, "Well, 2 minutes." And he seemed incredulous that he would even bother. And I said, "Well, that's the way I roll, and that's where I've been raised, to give you an option. If I can keep it or you want it, take your choice."
Was that the last time that that happened?
Yeah, absolutely the last time.
You never saw your father again?
No contact. I called him a couple of times, and I spoke to him on the phone, very brief conversations.
Yeah.
He was busy. When I got married, I sent him an invitation to the wedding. I got a note from Barbara saying, well, he has other plans. When I had my firstborn, I sent him a birth announcement, never heard anything. I'm confident that he never saw any of that stuff. So.
You think Barbara kept it from him somehow?
I do.
And when Zeppo Marx passed away, I mean, several years had gone by, decades since you'd seen him. What were your feelings?
I cried about it. I was on my way to work one day when I found out it was on the radio. Nobody had told me that he was sick. I never knew. And then suddenly he's gone. And I'm sad because, geez, you know, maybe I should try harder to call him and speak with him to find out what was going on. And I didn't. So I had a bit of remorse there. And I got a lovely letter from Barbara Sinatra saying, you know, if there's anything I could ever do for you, let me know. That's a whole other story. But then I got cards and letters from everybody. And some of the people I get cards from are people now I still talk to. And so, you know, it was sad, but there you go.
Well, Tim Marks, it's really been fascinating to speak with you. I want to thank you for making some time for From the Bookshelf. Sure,
well,
appreciate it.
This has been absolutely great. I hope that I've given you some insight and some things that heretofore unknown. And without malice, by the way.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.